It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a lot of us are focused on getting the most out of our time and being as efficient as we can be. The author of a new time management book wants to flip that around so that we know we can never do it all, so we should focus on the things that matter most. First, some developing news out of Afghanistan, where the Taliban has allowed a commercial flight with over 100 people on board to fly out of the country. That flight included Americans, people with permanent residency in the U.S., and other Western passport holders. It's the first departure by air since U.S. forces withdrew from Afghanistan early last week. Another flight is scheduled for tomorrow. For over a week, the Taliban had grounded flights from the northern city of Mazar-e Sharif, saying there were issues with some Afghans' travel documents. Yesterday, they said Americans could venture to Kabul and fly out there. It's not clear how many Americans remain in Mazar-e Sharif. At least one Republican congressman called the groundings a hostage situation, saying the Taliban was using the flights as leverage to get full recognition from the U.S. The Biden administration denied there's any such activity. Our next guest says all of this never should have happened and is worried about what the Taliban will do to people left behind in Afghanistan, both Americans and those who worked with Americans over the last two decades. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your take on what's happening now in Afghanistan? Do you think it was a mistake to pull all U.S. troops out before all Americans were evacuated? How worried are you about what's going to happen to them? What do you want to see the Biden administration do now, if anything? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Matt Lewis is a senior columnist with The Daily Beast and the author of Too Dumb to Fail, How the GOP Went from the Party of Reagan to the Party of Trump. Matt, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
You wrote a little over a week ago, Matt, that you were disappointed, I'm understating a little bit here, in how the Biden administration handled the evacuation of Americans who wanted to leave Afghanistan. Where did you think things went wrong?
Well, I think fundamentally the idea of withdrawing troops before American citizens was just a fundamental problem. In fact, President Biden said that quote, if there's American citizens left, we're going to stay to get them all out. I think most Americans think troops should have remained in the country until all Americans were out. And, you know, clearly I'm hoping that we do get them all. But if we do, we're sort of relying on the goodwill of the Taliban, which I hope we can rely on that. I don't think I would bet my life or even my presidency on the goodwill of the Taliban.
We're seeing some flights now leaving Afghanistan, being cleared to leave today, another one tomorrow. Some Americans at least on the flight out today. Are you encouraged by that, seeing at least some people successfully leaving the country without U.S. troops there?
Absolutely. I think, you know, first of all, it's a good sign. And second, just every American that we get out is very very good news. And, you know, again, I hope it turns out that this was overblown, you know, that concerns were overblown. You know, the Taliban actually has one American hostage that they've had, you know, for over a year now. And there's also just, you know, the potential, of course, that other groups like ISIS-K could kidnap some American who got left behind. So we're not out of the woods yet, but I do think it's promising.
In your piece you wrote about this, you kind of compared a post-Vietnam feeling that what concern that POWs, American military members, had been left behind in Vietnam. And that there was a huge political and pop culture movement that arose out of that. You compared and contrasted with today. What do you see?
Yeah, I think it's it's not a perfect analogy, but we are talking about leaving Americans behind. And keep in mind, you know, during the entire Iranian hostage crisis, that was based on like 52 Americans being held captive. The Canadian caper, which the movie Argo was based on, you know, was this elaborate plot to rescue just six Americans. And so the idea of hundreds of Americans being left behind, it's really hard to say the impact that could have on the American psyche, whether real or imagined, you know, possibly spurring conspiracy theories. But yeah, I think that, again, it's not a perfect analogy, but when I was a kid growing up, we had all these movies. It was like, mm-hmm. Chuck Norris's Missing in Action, Gene Hackman's Uncommon Valor, Sylvester Stallone's Rambo First Blood Part 2. And they were all sort of living out this fantasy of going back to Vietnam and rescuing prisoners of war. I still occasionally see these black POW MIA flags when I'm driving around in rural areas. So this is something that I think was part of a deep-seated part of the American conscious when you lose a war and when a war ends the way that this one did. So I'm hoping that that there isn't a similar sort of movement that is necessitated by the way we withdrew from Afghanistan.
Talking to Matt Lewis, columnist at the Daily Beast. He wrote a piece saying the Biden administration moved too fast to remove troops from Afghanistan before American civilians were completely evacuated from that country. You can join in with your thoughts, your agreements or disagreements at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Matt, I think one concern is we had a deadline negotiated by President Trump for earlier this year, and then it was extended till the end of August by the Biden administration. The concern, I think, that if we keep pushing back deadlines, they're not really deadlines. We're just going to keep on keeping on leaving American troops there. What do you make of that line of thinking?
I think that, I disagree with what President Biden did, but I think that the choice to withdraw is, a legitimate decision that the president can make. And I get the point about deadlines. I will say, I remember that Secretary Lloyd Austin at one point said something to the effect of, we're going to get as many Americans out as long as time will permit or until the clock runs out. I'm paraphrasing, but something to that effect, until the clock runs out. And at the time, I remember thinking, well, that's not sufficient. Like, we should be negotiating from a position of strength, which says, hey, Taliban, we're going to get Americans out and then we're going to leave. Clearly, we weren't doing that. But here's the thing. We actually didn't even do it up until the clock ran out. We withdrew our troops from Afghanistan before the clock expired. So I don't know. Maybe it was impossible that we could have gotten more Americans out before we left. But we didn't even really push it up until the limit of the deadline that Joe Biden decided to honor.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jake is with us now in Milwaukee. Jake, hello.
Hi, thank you for having me.
What did you want to bring up, Jake?
So, given that I think it's common sense a 10-year-old could have figured out that you evacuate the citizens before you withdraw the military, given that this is one of the hugest foreign policy blunders in history, do you think it's appropriate that Joe Biden should be offering his resignation?
Jake, thanks for the call. Matt, what do you think?
I don't know about that, but I will say I wrote a column saying that somebody should be fired or resign, and that could be Secretary of State Blinken or Lloyd Austin or someone else. But this is a disaster, and maybe the most concerning part is the Americans being left behind. But so much of this withdrawal went so bad that I do think there should be some accountability. And somebody should, I think, be fired or resign over this. And nobody has. I remember when President Trump decided to withdraw from Syria, which I think, similarly, that really pulled the rug out from under our Kurdish allies in that instance. In this instance, I think we did a similar thing to the Afghan interpreters, but General Mattis resigned in protest and did what I think was the honorable thing. Nobody so far in the Biden administration has done that.
Thanks for that call. We're talking about the U.S. exit from Afghanistan and the remaining American citizens still there. Matt Lewis is with us, senior columnist with the Daily Beast, author of the book Too Dumb to Fail, How the GOP Went from the Party of Reagan to the Party of Trump. He wrote a recent piece criticizing the Biden administration's handling of troop withdrawals and civilian evacuations from Afghanistan. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think? Should we have kept some troops there until we got all U.S. citizens out, or more of them anyway? Or was it right to stick to the withdrawal deadline? Do you see this as a big blunder by the Biden administration? Or do they deserve credit for the 100,000 plus people they did evacuate over the last month? Do you trust the Taliban to let the remaining Americans leave safely? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're talking about the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan and the U.S. citizens who remain in the country. Matt Lewis stays with us, senior columnist with the Daily Beast. He's been writing about Afghanistan and the withdrawal over the last couple of weeks, including a piece criticizing President Biden's handling of the exit, saying we should have kept troops in place until all Americans were evacuated. He says we can't necessarily trust the Taliban to allow remaining Americans to leave safely. You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's go back to your calls now. Kathleen is with us in Rhinelander. Kathleen, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Kathleen?
This whole controversy over, you know, leaving Americans behind and all that stuff, this whole withdrawal from Afghanistan was like no big surprise that was done, you know, like overnight. We've known through two administrations that America was getting out of Afghanistan from both Trump and Biden. And I wonder why the Americans who are there for whatever reason didn't start leaving way back during the Trump administration, because they could pretty much see the writing on the wall.
Kathleen, thanks for the call. Matt, what do you think? This was a long time coming, she says.
Well, I would say I'm a wimp, and so I would have never, I don't think I would have wasted much time getting out of Afghanistan myself. But one argument for why people, and by the way, I mean, there are, you know, people have reasons to stay, including some of them are humanitarians,
right,
who are there, you know, doing the Lord's work, really. And one reason they might have stayed was that they listened to Joe Biden. I mean, if you were listening to what President Biden had to say in the run up to this, it was like everything's going to be okay. He was not saying that this is going to be catastrophic. The predictions were that maybe Kabul would fall like in a year or something to that effect, that the Afghan security forces were going to be able to provide security. And so if you were really listening to Joe Biden and believing him, you very well may have thought that you could stay safely.
Kathleen, thanks a lot for calling in at 800-642-1234. Steve joins us next in Stoughton. Steve, hello.
Hey, I just want to say I fully support withdrawal of troops. The war, we went into war kind of unjustly. And honestly, if there was any thought that folks who might be staying would be protected by the Afghan government or the Afghan military, which we spent, you know, billions of dollars arming and training, there was never, ever, you know, the hope that the Afghani military was going to protect anybody. And that was obvious by what happened after we started withdrawing. So maybe there was a glimmer of hope that they would, but in the end, nothing.
Steve, thanks a lot for the call. A couple of things there, Matt. First of all, the super fast collapse of the Afghanistan government. I mean, the president fleeing, local commanders and local government leaders negotiating quick surrenders to the Taliban, that I think caught most people, not everybody, but most people by surprise how fast that went.
I think that's exactly right. And again, if you had been listening to the administration, you would have been surprised based on their assessments. And, you know, I think a lot of folks were just trying to, they weren't trying to stay indefinitely. They were trying to stay, you know, up until the last moment. They wanted to get out when the withdrawal happened, the deadline, and they ended up making a very, very bad mistake, I think, by waiting that long. You know, another point I wanted to bring up that is interesting is, you know, I've been talking about how the administration got some things wrong in terms of, say, predicting, you know, how long Kabul would hold and how long the Afghan security forces would hold. Something else that they really messed up on is in the lead up to the withdrawal, they said that there were 10 to 15,000 Americans, they estimated, who were in Afghanistan. And then right before the withdrawal, they changed it to 6,000. And that also, I think, fed into suspicion that, well, maybe they're wrong about this. Maybe we're leaving even more Americans behind. They say we're only going to leave 1 to 200 behind, but maybe there will be more. So, you know, again, that very well just may be incompetence or just, you know, the fog of war. But by getting that wrong, it did raise suspicion that maybe there are more Americans than they're letting on.
And our caller also mentioned the fundamental decision to leave Afghanistan, which is one of the few, I think if you made a list of things that former President Trump and current President Biden agreed on, it was withdrawing from Afghanistan. You were worried, you didn't like that decision, I think, from either administration. You were hoping to see administrations stay there and make the case to the American people of why we might want to see there. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. I think that Donald Trump deserves a lot of blame. I mean, this is someone who, remember, here we are about to celebrate or to commemorate the 20th anniversary of 9/11. Donald Trump. I don't want to beat up on Joe Biden anymore. Donald Trump invited the Taliban to Camp David on 9/11. It was Donald Trump who decided to negotiate with the Taliban without the Afghan government being present. Of course, the Afghan government, you know, didn't stand up. I mean, we basically cut them out of the negotiation from day one. So I think Trump deserves a lot of blame. Yeah, and you know, I think that reasonable people can disagree over this. I know a lot of smart, great people who think we really had to get out of Afghanistan and that it was we were going to lose. I tend to believe that we accomplished the goal in the sense that we have not had a major terror attack on the homeland in the last 20 years. I don't think it's about exporting democracy, but I think that we were able to maintain a residual force in Afghanistan without suffering a lot of casualties that simultaneously prevented groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS from reforming and having a safe haven, as they now do. And honestly, I just think having the Bagram Air Base was a smart would have been, I'm stunned that we gave that up, especially before the withdrawal. But for geopolitical reasons, if nothing else, having that base, I think would have really helped American security. So, yeah, I guess I'm sort of a neoconservative hawk when it comes to this issue.
Talking to Matt Lewis, senior columnist of the Daily Beast, about the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. Back to your calls now. Vicky is with us in Greenleaf. Vicky, hi.
Yeah, your guest kind of answered my question in his last statement. Because I had heard that when the initial that the president or head of Afghanistan told his troops to back off and just surrender, and then I was concerned about that original deal back in 2020 when they weren't, like, that guy wasn't involved. It was just like talking to the Taliban. So, but it also raises another question on where the information of the status was coming from over there. Like, you would think the commanders on the ground must have made the calls and given the counsel to the president. And what were they seeing on the ground that led them to believe that the Taliban, and maybe they just didn't count on the head of Afghanistan, like, calling for surrender. And what was the communication between, like, the commanders there and the head of the Afghani government.
Vicki, thanks for the call. And Matt, I think historians and others are going to be asking those exact questions for years to come.
Yeah, it seems like what happened is that, you know, America was providing intelligence support and air support for the Afghan government and the security forces, and that without that, they were sitting ducks. We did not train them to fight without our providing intel and air support. And so really, I think what Joe Biden and the American government wanted from the Afghanistan security forces was for them to just keep fighting and dying long enough for us to safely extricate ourselves, and then they could keep fighting and dying, and a year later, they would be overpowered by the Taliban, and Kabul would fall, and we'd be gone by then. I think that's what we were banking on, and I think that they both just sort of logistically, because they couldn't do it without the air support, and because I think we really undermined their morale by negotiating with the Taliban without them. They didn't have the heart to kind of keep fighting in that environment. So I think both logistically and sort of spiritually, they lost the will and the ability to fight. And Joe Biden, I think, again, was counting on them to give him a little cover, and they didn't do that.
Just in our last 30 seconds or so, Matt, earlier you said someone ought to be held accountable, maybe be fired or resign. Do you have names on your list?
I think Secretary Blinken is at the top of the list. If anybody's interested, I would really encourage you to go watch a YouTube clip of John McCain going after Anthony Blinken in 2014 when he was nominated to be Barack Obama's national security advisor. It's eye-opening. And I did not realize, but I think John McCain kind of saw this coming and predicted what would happen. So he's at the top of my list. I think he misled us in Afghanistan on several occasions. And President Biden's not going to resign over this. So I think next in line might be him.
Matt, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Matt Lewis is a senior columnist at the Daily Beast, author of the book Too Dumb to Fail, How the GOP Went from the Party of Reagan to the Party of Trump. We talked to him today about U.S. citizens still in Afghanistan and the ongoing effort to evacuate them. Coming up, do you ever feel like you don't have enough time to do all the stuff you need to do and want to do? The author of a new book says accepting that time is limited and finite might help you manage the time you do have. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show, the Packers kick off their regular season this weekend after some off-season drama. Get a preview of the opening game and beyond. Ensure your hopes for the team. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, there are lots and lots of books and workshops and tools and apps out there that try to help us make the best use of our time, promoting time management and productivity hacks. The author of a new book takes a different approach. Instead of focusing on being more efficient and getting more done, he wants us to accept that we'll never get it all done. Time is limited. You'll never have time for everything. And that's good news if we know what to do with it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you tried using time management advice from a book or an app or whatnot? Did anything work for you? Or did you feel as busy as you did before or even busier? How do you make time for the things that are important to you in your life, whatever those may be? How do you decide what's important for you to spend your time on? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Oliver Berkman is a journalist and author. He wrote a long-running weekly column on psychology called This Column Will Change Your Life for The Guardian. His new book is called 4,000 Weeks, Time Management for Mortals. Oliver, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks very much. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, 4,000 weeks. When I found out what that meant, it's a little disturbing in a way. What's up with 4,000 weeks, Oliver?
4,000 weeks is very approximately the number of weeks you're going to get if you live to be around 80. I definitely rounded the number for for effect. But I think that what's really important about that number is not really the exact figure. It's just that any life, even the sort of record-breaking, very long-lived people who sort of live until they're like 120, it's all so finite. When you think about it in weeks, it's 4,000, maybe 5,000 if you're lucky. It's not a lot.
You have tried lots of other time management advice over the years and productivity tips and things like that. What is the focus of a lot of the stuff out there that you see steering us in the wrong direction?
I mean, there's good stuff as well as bad stuff. But what there is and what I was for a long time is this phenomenon of people using this advice to try really to feel completely in control of time, to feel like they have their lives in working order, to feel like there is nothing that could be thrown at them that they would be unable to deal with, no ambition they could have that they couldn't put into practice. You know, it's this kind of omnipotence that I think we are seeking and that a lot of productivity gurus are encouraging us to try to achieve. And my argument is, you know, number one, it's not possible for a finite human to be omnipotent with respect to time. Number two, it's not even a worthwhile thing to try to do, because what it does is it actually undermines your ability to have time and focus for the things that matter the most to you in life.
Yeah, this idea that if I'm just efficient in how I use my time, I'm going to get to do all the stuff that I want to do, that other people want me to do. I'll keep up with my work. My house is going to be clean. I'm going to make great meals. Like, right, you can't do it, can you?
No, right. We live in, especially today, I think it's always been true in some sense, but especially today, because of technology, the economy, a lot of other things, we live in a world of what I call infinite inputs, right? There's always another email that you could be sent. There's always another demand your boss could make. Likewise, you know, there's always another exotic location you could have on your bucket list. It's not all unpleasant things, but it is all these kind of limitless inputs. And trying to get more efficient at getting through some limitless inputs is like, you know, getting faster at climbing up an infinitely tall ladder. You feel more rushed, but you're never going to get to the top of it because it's infinite.
So the core of your book, it seems to be, it's a mindset change. What is the mindset you're hoping to shake us into here?
The mindset I'm hoping to shake us into, which you know, absolutely is one that I have had to struggle with myself and still to some extent do struggle with, is to just see the facts, to just understand that getting on top of everything, doing everything, it's completely off the table to begin with. It's not that you failed to find the right time management technique or that you weren't self-disciplined enough. It's like trying to make 2 + 2 add up to 5, right? It's not going to happen. Once you see that, and once you can deal with the discomfort that arises from that, because it is an uncomfortable realization, at that point, you can instead choose to put your time and your attention onto a handful of things that matter the most. You have to give up this feeling that next month or next year, that's when you're going to be fully optimized, totally efficient, totally in control. Because of course, anyone like me who's struggled to try to achieve this feeling, like, it's always off in the future. It's never now. It's always like you're just being led towards, like, maybe it's soon, but it actually never happens. And I think giving up hope in that respect, admitting defeat in a certain way, is actually the first step to being way more effective when it comes to using your time on things that you really care about.
Talking to Oliver Berkman about his new book, 4,000 Weeks, Time Management for Mortals. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have trouble deciding how to best spend your time? Do you feel overwhelmed trying to do it all? Have you had a realization that you can't do it all? How do you prioritize what is important in your life to spend your time on? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Oliver, I'm going to describe a feeling I often have, and I'm guessing from your book, a lot of people have it. I'm doing a thing, watching a movie, playing a computer game, hanging out, whatever. At the back of my mind is the fact that the thing I'm doing means I'm not doing all the other cool things I could be doing, or important things I could be doing in the world. How do I shake that? How do we shake that?
Well, again, I'm not sure you should shake it. I think you should kind of almost go deeper into it and see, like, that feeling is reflecting the fact that every time we decide to do anything with an hour, with a week, with a lifetime, we are, by definition, right, neglecting a million other things. It's just the way it works to be a finite human. And I actually think that's one of those feelings that it's most tormenting when you sort of feel it a little bit. It's less tormenting when you really stare it in the face, because then you see, sure, you know, I'm always going to be missing out on stuff. Never mind the fear of missing out that, you know, is supposed to sort of ruin our lives these days. It's the inevitability of missing out. And I think once you accept that, you can sort of stop beating yourself up for the fact that you're choosing one thing over another thing. And that's when you can make better choices, and you can ask, like, okay, is the thing I'm doing right now with my time the most meaningful thing for me in my circumstance in life to be doing it? So it's kind of really liberating to give up this hope that one day you're going to somehow be able to not miss out on things.
How do we do that kind of arranging, figuring out the things that are important to us or that are going to make us happy or fulfilled or whatever good thing we're looking for? How do we sort that out and then put it at the top of that list for some of our buckets of time?
It's a really good question. I mean, in the book, I do get into some really sort of down-to-earth little tips and techniques, but I think that the most important point is this kind of, it's this mindset shift that we're talking about. It's this willingness to tolerate some discomfort. And I think it is just this recognition that a lot of the things that matter to us the most don't always feel really comfortable. They don't always feel really good. If you're working on a difficult piece of creative work, or you are looking after a child who you love deeply, something like that, you're going to encounter like resistance, boredom, the feeling that it's too difficult and you want to do something that feels more pleasant, like, you know, just scroll through your phone on social media or something. And that's fine, because all you're feeling there is the fact that I think the things that matter to us do bring us up against our edges and our limitations. They do challenge us because the stakes are higher. And I think just sort of expecting it to feel that way makes a huge difference, because soon it then, you know, I don't think the discomfort always lasts. I think you can get into sort of deep absorption and fulfillment from doing these activities, but just not expecting any of this to be like super comfortable right from the start, I think makes a massive difference.
We're talking to Oliver Berkman, journalist and author, about his new book. It's called 4,000 Weeks, Time Management for Mortals. He says, instead of trying to get so efficient that we can do it all the things we want and have to do in our lives, we are probably better off realizing that we're finite. We don't have that much time. We can't do it all. And that's going to help us realize what's important, what we want to spend our time doing when we have the choice. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Does any of this ring a bell with you? Did you realize that, hey, maybe there are some things I'm spending a lot of time on that don't bring me happiness or joy or fulfillment, and I can stop them or maybe spend less time on them? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your experiences, maybe your questions for our guest. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk now with author Oliver Berkman. His new book is called 4,000 Weeks, Time Management for Mortals. He says, no matter how much time management and productivity training we get, we can't do all the stuff we want to do in life or feel like we should do in life, and that's okay. And knowing that is actually going to help us pick and choose and use our time in good ways. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you tried time management advice in a book or an app or whatever? How did it work for you? Have you realized there are things you can leave out? You don't have to get through every email, say, in your inbox. Your yard doesn't have to look perfect, so you can use that time on better stuff. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring out a caller now. Destiny is with us in Milwaukee. Destiny, hello.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about?
I really appreciate the guest speaker talking about how you just sometimes may be uncomfortable with these realizations. And something that really helped me was to stop using the word should Especially as a new mom, I constantly am telling myself, like, you should be doing the laundry, or you should be helping with the yard work, or whatever that may be. And realizing that if I just changed the word should to could, I was much more comfortable with what I was actually choosing to spend my time on. So I could be doing the laundry, or I could be making a phone call to a really good friend, and just feeling still fulfilled with what I was doing.
Destiny, I'm glad you could make a call to us. Thank you so much for sharing that. Oliver, what do you think of what Destiny had to say?
I think that's just a fantastic point. I think that, you know, the word should is so interesting because you can generate a list of 100 things that you feel you should be doing. There's no reason to believe that that is going to be, that you're going to have enough time for all those things, right? I mean, maybe you've got time for 5 of them. But so our minds are capable of this kind of limitless level of, you know, beating ourselves up for all the things we're supposed to be doing. And it just sort of floats free of the basic math, which is like there are so many hours in the day and you're going to have to sleep for some of them. And you should try to give a little bit of time to resting and to doing things for yourself. So I think it's a great, great point. And of course, there are things that we feel duty bound to do, but it really makes no sense to think that we're duty bound to do more things than it's humanly possible to do. That's just a non-starter.
Destiny, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Oliver, reading your book, what I thought about a lot is my experience with vacations. Once upon a time, if I'd paid the money to go somewhere and taken the time to get somewhere and knowing I probably would never get back, I'd have the mindset that I have to see every single thing there is to see and eat all the foods and, you know, all the stuff. And then I said, you know what? No, I'm going to just enjoy bits and pieces and know I'm going to miss stuff. And I enjoy traveling a whole lot more when I get the opportunity to do it. That I don't know. That's what I thought about reading your book. That mindset I should maybe take from my travel to the rest of my life.
I think it's, yes, I absolutely. I mean, I think what's going on there is this way that we almost turn leisure into another kind of work.
Yeah.
And what we're doing there in work as well as in leisure is really focusing on the instrumental benefits of time, right? We're thinking about time entirely as something that we're using for some future purpose. And in the case of vacations, it's the future purpose of that lovely satisfied feeling that you really got the most out of your vacation. But if you completely fixate on using time for future benefit, you're kind of not present to the time itself, and the present and the future kind of never arrives. So you miss your life. I think it's a really good point. I think it's actually worth thinking about vacations and days off as an opportunity to waste time. Like almost, I think we need that in our culture these days. We're so wired to try to use all our leisure time well. It's almost a challenge to try to almost deliberately do something that has no benefit for our careers or for the future or for our families, et cetera, et cetera.
Talking to Oliver Berkman about his new book. It's called 4,000 Weeks, Time Management for Mortals. Still time for you to share your thoughts, your experiences, or maybe your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. If you'd like, that's 800-642-1234. 1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Oliver, you've mentioned here and you write about this. You're working toward this mindset shift. You're encouraging it for others, but it isn't always easy, even for you, having worked on this for some years now. What are some of the roadblocks you've encountered?
I mean, I just think that I have, and I think a lot of people have, a pretty deep-seated notion that we need to do a huge amount of stuff. We need to be incredibly productive, not just to pay the rent and to make our lives sort of work out financially, which we do, I accept that, but to feel like we've justified our existence on the planet. You know, there's a whole self-worth piece built into this where you kind of think that it would be somehow immoral if you spent the whole day in the park reading a novel. Now, you might not be able to spend the whole day in the park reading the novel because of your financial situation or your employment situation. But if you get those little chances, even for a half an hour here or there, like, I think the big challenge is, like, don't make it into a thing where you're like, you feel like you're not justified in existing unless you are producing stuff. So that for me has been a big challenge. This notion that, like, you're enough regardless of what you produce. And then, sure, go ahead and produce some things and accomplish some things because that's good to do, but not as the condition of your, not as your sort of price of admission for being human, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, and you write about, and this is getting more toward the practical side of things, I think, there are a lot of things we can do that might feel productive, but there may be distractions from the good stuff, or whatever the good stuff might be. How do we tell one from the other?
Well, we live, don't we, in this culture that sort of really, really champions doing things, kind of almost regardless of what the things are. If you get to the end of a work day and you like did a lot of stuff, you're liable to feel very virtuous, like you did your part. But there's no virtue inherently in just doing things. It depends what things. So yeah, I think there are a lot of techniques and approaches to this. A very simple one is that if you have the control over your work day, not everyone does, but if you have, to really try to spend the first 2 or 3 hours on something that really counts and that really matters, and to just not touch the inbox or the little bits of admin until after you've put in those 2 or 3 hours, to resist this urge to say, well, okay, I just got into work, I'm going to clear the decks, get everything a little out of the way so that I can focus. Because of course what happens is you never clear the decks. In fact, the act of trying to clear the decks just generates more stuff on the decks. So, putting what matters the most first for a sort of ring fence 2 or 3 hours in the day is an incredibly powerful practice, I think.
I want to get a little more into something you've mentioned a couple times now, the idea that at some point in the future, I'm going to have the time to do the stuff or the resources, when I have the good job or when I retire or when the kids move out or whatever. What advice do you have for us to take that future and start working it into our daily life now?
Well, I love this insight that comes from a creativity coach called Jessica Abel, who says that, you know, this idea from personal finance about paying yourself first, in other words, putting a bit of money into savings as soon as you receive a paycheck instead of hoping that it'll be left over when you've spent all your, you know, paid all your bills and bought your groceries and everything. The same applies to time. If you think that, writing a novel, writing songs, or nurturing a specific relationship in your life, whatever it is the thing that you really plan to do when you get the time, the only way is to do a little bit of it right now, you know, to do a little bit of it today, even if it's half an hour, even if it's 20 minutes, even if you don't feel ready or qualified yet to do that thing. Pay yourself first with time. Do a little bit of that right now and keep doing that as many days as you can. And just accept that, yeah, you're going to feel like, no, I wanted to wait a few years until I was in the right frame of mind. But just understand that that's a trap.
Leslie in Cottage Grove emailed us. Leslie says, once you're retired, you have a great sense of time's limits and it becomes easier to choose to spend time on things that personally matter. I can work on whatever I want to. Well, I want to spend just the last half a minute, Oliver, remind us the realization that we can realize those limits of time right now and start working with it.
Right. I mean, I really take that point. I think it's excellent about retirement, and I think it really does liberate a lot of people. But the difference between someone in retirement and someone earlier on in life, like, we're all on this, it's not that huge. We're all in this very short little span of time, and we could all do to, I think, spend a bit more time on what we care about the most and a bit less time convincing ourselves that we one day might be able to do everything.
Well, Oliver, thanks for using some of your time with us today. I appreciate it.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
Oliver Berkman is a journalist and author. We've been talking about his latest book. It's called 4,000 Weeks, Time Management for Mortals. You can still share your thoughts, maybe your own advice. Email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at @CentralTimeWPR. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the weekend marks the 20th anniversary of the September 11th attacks. How should we teach younger generations about the event and its impact? Our guests have advice on the best ways to tell that story. It's been a long time in the making. The human genome map was completed this year. A Wisconsin researcher tells us what that can mean for the future of medicine. Plus, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. A Wisconsin author shares her love of home cooking and lots of advice and encouragement for first-timers and for longtime home cooks. Plus some recipes. That and more. It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. I've I've mentioned on the show a time or two that I've gotten into jigsaw puzzles over the last year, like a lot of people. They were never my jam in the past, but I learned how to enjoy them. I haven't done one for a few months now, but I think as fall rolls in and then winter, I may break them out again. I've enjoyed big puzzles, those 1,000-piece ones. My wife and I work on them together. Okay, 1,000 pieces is big, but you know what's bigger? 40,000 pieces. As reported in the Marietta Times in Ohio, the Marietta Municipal Court building has a puzzle on display that clocks in at 40,320 pieces. The puzzler behind that puzzle is a local public defender. Attorney Ray Smith says he's loved puzzles since he was a kid. A local judge who found out about his mega puzzle hobby invited him to bring one in and display it. What does it take to build a 40,000-piece jigsaw puzzle? When you're working on it by yourself or on your day job, apparently it takes 349 days to assemble. How do you move a puzzle that size? You do it in 10 separate sections, then piece them back together at the courthouse. This particular puzzle featured scenes from classic Disney movies. I think 1,000 pieces is still going to be my maximum. If I try to go to 40,000, I think I'm going to need a bigger table. Picking up the pieces, this is Central Time.